Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in. Got a good one lined up for you today. Is this thing on? God dang it. Check one, check two. Can you hear me now? Alright, well. I forgot to join up the chat room again. Well, anyway, I'll get to it. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Scott Horton. It is the Scott Horton Show. If you go to my website, the new and improved, scotthorton.org, you can find all my interview archives, my whole show archives, too. 3,000 interviews now going back to 2003. You can find my blog and some other things. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show, if you're interested in that. And yeah, scotthorton.org/chat. That's where I meant to be, but I forgot. I'm about to click on that now. Join up the chat room and try to keep an eye out for y'all's comments during the show there. Always entertaining, oftentimes useful. So, I'm logging in now for that. You don't need any kind of external applications or Chatzillas or XChat or Pigeon or anything. Just go to scotthorton.org/chat, fill out the CAPTCHA, put in a fake name, and you're in. There you go, scotthorton.org/chat. Hang out with all the people in there if you want to do that. All right, now yesterday I told you about this story in the Washington Times about Afghanistan, and you might not have believed me. It sounds so outlandish. Obama's Afghanistan experts stumped on U.S. death toll, war costs, during hearing. That's right. The Obama team's experts, the head weenies, the deputy undersecretary of getting people killed in Afghanistan at the State Department and at the Pentagon, and one other guy, I forgot who he was. One was a civilian, the other was a military guy, and then the State Department guy. A civilian DOD. You understand what I mean. And anyway, they didn't know. They didn't even have a ballpark estimate. And I bet you, since you're a decent, honest person, that it was just beyond your imagination that that could possibly be true. And, you know, that Scott Horton guy, he says a lot of things, and I guess sometimes he lies just for effect, because how could that possibly be true, that they didn't even have a ballpark estimate? That must be Scott Horton off the deep end into hyperbole now. He must be misreading something from the Mooney Times there. No way, you said to yourself yesterday, right? Just because you're a decent and honest person. And it just is beyond the capacity, as C-3PO would say, that this could happen, you know? That it just couldn't be right, except that here's the audio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We go now to Mr. Dana Rohrabacher of California.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don't know where to begin here. How much are we spending annually in Afghanistan now? How much does the aid cost the American taxpayer? Anybody know?
I mean, I think we each of us have somewhat different budgets there. The total budget,
What would be nobody knows the total budget of what we're spending in Afghanistan? It's a hearing on Afghanistan. Can I have an estimate?
I'm sorry, Congressman.
I'll just have to say that it's disheartening to have a briefing from our government people who are involved in a project, and they can't tell me how much we're spending annually. And
it is an amount.
How many killed and wounded have we suffered in the last 12 months? Mr. Dumont, would you know that?
Sir, I do not. I'll have to get back with you on that one also.
We don't know what the cost is, and we don't even know how many killed and wounded are. And we're supposed to believe that you fellows have a plan that's going to end up in a positive way in Afghanistan? Holy cow.
We do know that the number of Afghan soldiers and police killed is 30 times the number.
You know what? I'll have to tell you something. I'm more interested in knowing how many Americans have been killed, because the Afghans have been killing themselves for centuries. And, you know, my father fought in Korea, and I remember when he told me, he said...
All right, well, you know, Rohrabacher goes on in his feigned outrage here. At least he's anti-war now. You can never tell with this guy flip-flopping around. But the point is made there. I didn't mute anything. I didn't hit pause to exaggerate the effect there. The dead silence was the dead silence in the room. As Obama's top experts on Afghanistan could not even estimate the amount of money spent or even the number of American soldiers and Marines killed in Afghanistan in the last year. By the way, it's now up to 126. Six more of them died in a plane crash yesterday, or helicopter crash yesterday. But the guys running the war, the guys send them over there, they're not even paying enough attention to the war that they're in charge of to even know. That's right, because they don't care. They never cared. It's not of interest to them. The only way it would have been of interest to them is if one of their lower-level PR flacks had said, "Oh, Mr. Deputy Undersecretary, before you go out there, you probably should know the number of dead just in case they ask." Somebody like that might be able to think of it. But Mr. Deputy Undersecretary? And it's hilarious, too. You look at this thing. The reason you could barely hear him is because the guy's just slouching back in his chair. He's not even leaning forward to talking to the microphone. He's just sitting there. His entire body language says, if your son died in Afghanistan doing what I told him to do in the last year, hey, I didn't even notice. I don't know. I don't. It's what would be right and just and expectable in a just society. Is that a word? What one would be justified in expecting in a society with a so-called rule of law and this, that, and the other thing would be for all those men to have to resign right there on the spot. That's it. They're beyond disgraced. They're ruined. Their entire lives and careers have been completely and totally dishonored now for their failure to be able to even estimate the number of American dead in the last year in the Afghan war. Never mind how much money it cost. Oh, gee, I don't know. Probably one of our departments employs a bean counter who may have or may not have added it up, Congressman. You know how those things go. There you go. That's the Democrats in wartime, which in a way, I guess we got to be thankful that, and it's kind of preferable to a hands-on approach, don't you think? What if Obama got in his head that he had to be like Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt or Harry Truman or some great man like that? Go be an actor on the world stage in a way that guarantees, you know, historical significance unto the ages. Think of all the people he could get killed. So, pretty good thing that, I don't know, for me, I guess I'm willing to settle for complete and total inattention. But imagine, though, if that was your family, that was your son or your cousin or something, your brother. Yeah, I guess what I'm going to do, I'm going to get some money for college by joining the army. Then he gets blown up to death over in Afghanistan. And then the Democrats run in the war, go before Congress. They never even heard of him. They didn't even know that somebody died that day at all. They don't get briefed on that. They don't care about that. Man, that's something else. Seems like some Democrats would have to resign from power over that, at least, right? I mean, I'd like to see the president removed from office for that. How could he be so negligent? That's not a high crime for him to be so negligent that he's appointed people to run his war for him that don't even pay attention to it at all or care about it at all. What have they been doing? Sitting on the beach? Man, I don't know. Again, it's preferable to them paying attention in a lot of ways, I guess, but it seems kind of dishonorable is all. Mr. Sampler. That was the guy's name. Mr. Sampler and Mr. Dobbins, and I forget the other, but here it is. It's in the Washington Times. Obama's Afghanistan experts stumped on the U.S. death toll, war costs during hearing. And if you look at my Facebook page or my Twitter feed, you can watch the video there. It'll queue up for you. And just watch these guys shrug. Doesn't even matter to them at all. How many Americans died in the war? Guys, anybody estimate for me? And they just look at him. Huh? Huh? Well, we're just the guys in charge of it. What do we know? It's like reading Joseph Heller, only without the humor. But otherwise, set up just that same way, you know? All right, well. So now to Gaza. Actually, first of all, within regular so-called Israel, the Bedouins. Remember they said the other day, did you hear this? The Prawer plan to ethnically cleanse all the Bedouins out of the Negev Desert so that they can build Jewish-only towns there instead. And these are not occupied Palestinians. These are Bedouins who are Israeli citizens who live within the borders of Israel proper, as they call it. And there's 30, 40,000 of them, and they're being called illegal immigrants by the illegal immigrants. And so then the news was that they decided not to do it. There were huge protests across Israel, and especially in the occupied territories, and it was getting a lot of international attention, and also a lot of the right-wingers were against it because it was too generous. It was going to give them a concentration camp to go live in instead of just, I don't know, dumping them in the sea or something. So they were against it too on the Israeli right. And so they announced that they weren't going to do it. That seemed like a bit of a reprieve for the Bedouins of the Negev Desert. But now Jason Ditz writes at news.antiwar.com, quote, frozen by Prime Minister, Israel's forcible relocation plan for Bedouins continues. Despite last week's promise by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to, quote, freeze the plan, the Prawer plan continues to move forward in the Knesset and shows no signs of being on hold at all. The Prawer plan would involve declaring a handful of North Negev Bedouin villages as the only acceptable places for Bedouins to live and forcing some 30 to 40,000 Bedouins living across the rest of the Negev into them. The plan is hugely controversial for both its race-based land confiscation and plans to build Jewish-only towns at the locations of some of the forcibly depopulated Bedouin villages. The plan is overwhelmingly opposed by opposition parties in the Knesset, and many members of the far-right government have also complained the plan is doomed to failure without Bedouin acquiescence. Since announcing the plan was shelved, the Netanyahu government hasn't commented again on the matter, and the ongoing process in the Knesset suggests the plan is still very much alive, though whether it can pass the Knesset vote remains to be seen. Isn't that just like Benjamin Netanyahu? Yeah, you know what? You're right. We should freeze the plan. Go ahead and continue the plan. Geez, you know, we're under a lot of public pressure. You know what we should do is we should say that we're not doing it anymore. That'll throw them off for a week or so, you know? I don't know why I gave him a Vinny the Thug Italian accent there, but, you know, no offense, Italians. I compare you to Benjamin Netanyahu. All right, well, anyway. Oh, and then you may have heard this yesterday, but it bears repeating. It's very important that the Iranians have, it's very big of them, and I mean that seriously, not sarcastically. The Iranians have decided to ignore Barack Obama's new sanctions, not completely, but they've decided to go ahead and press on with the talks anyway. Now, part of the preliminary deal on the Iranian nuclear thing is that they're going to have a final deal in 6 months. And in the meantime, there won't be any new sanctions against them. And then there's all the dozen-something conditions that they've got to abide by, too, which we've been over on the show. But anyway, the point is, so Obama, apparently in a compromise with the senators, put them off for another month or so and said, don't pass any new sanctions on Iran, and I will. And he went ahead, and what he did was he didn't actually add whole new sanctions, but he blacklisted some companies who were still doing business with Iran in some capacity. I'm not sure the details, but anyway. So, in effect, these are new sanctions being put on Iran in violation of the deal, but not in violation of the letter of the deal, only the spirit, as the Russians pointed out. So what the Iranians did was they pulled out of the technical talks, the low-level talks on the implementation by their lower-level functionaries. Those were suspended for just a couple of few days, and then they decided, okay, well, we're going to go ahead and be the bigger man here, and we really want this deal, and we really want to see this through. So, you know, you can abuse us, but we're going to put up with it for now, at least, kind of thing, is what they said. And now the latest is that the Iranian foreign minister, Zarif, has complained to John Kerry about it. And of course, Kerry and Obama actually seem to have been doing as much as they could to convince the Senate to put off their sanctions, at least. But I would not put it past Obama and Kerry to screw this thing up yet. They certainly could. 6 months, in a way, okay, it makes it easier to get that interim deal, and then you have momentum on your side a bit, you know, by breaking it into two parts. But also, you're given the opposition 6 months, too. And, you know, how long the new president of Iran can keep the momentum with him on the, you know, in the concerning the internal politics of Iran and people supporting him and putting up with America's nonsense to see this deal through, that remains to be seen. And I guess, you know, they're supposed to have the whole thing solved by May, would be 6 months up. So, anyway, Barack Obama went and did something provocative. He did provoke them into pulling back a little bit, but now they're back in the talks. And keep in mind, again, that this is all over a manufactured crisis anyway, as Gareth Porter puts it. It's a big fake crisis anyway. Iran's nuclear program is a civilian nuclear program. It always has been. It's safeguarded by the International Atomic Energy Agency. It always has been. They are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty and have never violated it. This whole thing is a bunch of nonsense. You know, using nuclear scary as the excuse to try to beat Iran over the head and punish them for no longer being a satellite of the American Empire. Satellite state of the American Empire. That's basically it. Punishing them for their intransigence, their independence. And, you know, because nuclear does sound scary to anybody who's seen Godzilla movies or watched The Atomic Cafe, it makes a good excuse. But anyway, so don't mistake my putting all this importance on this deal being signed to me, and I think it's a real issue. I just want to see the fake issue put to bed, for crying out loud. Oh yeah, by the way, Marcy Wheeler and Jason Leopold coming up later on the show. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email Scott at scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And now a little bit about Yemen. I guess I did get to mention yesterday briefly about the drone strike in Yemen and the 17 people killed in a wedding party there. And, of course, you know, I always have ready to go a little rant about how Yemenis are people, even if you can't smell their burning corpses from here. And it shouldn't be too much to ask for Americans to at least every once in a while consider the humanity of those our government is slaughtering endlessly overseas. And so there's that. But then there's the other thing, too. Consequences for you. And well, Patrick Coburn, as usual, has a pretty much as good a take on it as anybody, if not better. And what he's saying is that the Al-Qaeda guys of the world, of which there are not that many, in the thousands now, but mostly, hey, that's pretty broadly defined Al-Qaeda there. Mostly what they're concerned with is killing Shia in the region. Not that that's okay, just that that's not really a war against us. Sort of somebody else's problem. You know what I mean? Except for the fact that we keep making it our problem. We, the people who control the policy of the United States government, keep making it a problem for us, the people who happen to live in this country, who may or may not consent to their so-called authority over this land. And Yemen is a great case in point. See, in Yemen, they got their own problems. They've got their Shiite rebellion in the north there, the Houthi rebellion, and they've got some socialists, as they say, in the south, which I think by the south they sort of mean to the north and east a little bit. I don't know. And then I guess down into the south too, and those are supposedly the socialists. I don't know how atheistic they could possibly be. Marxists on the Arabian Peninsula? Really? I guess so. I mean, you got the MEK kooks, right? Why not? So anyway, what the Americans do is they fly robots around, dropping Hellfire missiles on people and killing them. And then what happens is the locals end up resenting that. And this is the kind of thing that could lead, at some point, to violence that affects the Americans. And really, the worst thing I could say about that, I think, would be what an excuse it would be for the government to crack down even further and wage even worse war. Because truthfully, the threat of terrorism to the actual lives of the American people is almost nil. I mean, even if they wage some massive attack or something, it probably still wouldn't amount to very much other than symbolically. I mean, it would be a lot if it was your loved one who died in it, but I'm just saying, the likelihood of you dying in one wouldn't even change, really. If there was one big attack, you still would be more likely to be hit by lightning and killed, or hit by a truck and killed, or shot by a cop for no reason at all, except he felt like it, and killed, than die in a terrorist attack. So, as far as the actual risk going up for any particular American, I guess that much is not really changing, but the possibility that they could, you know, some terrorists could get away with something big in this country. Like, say, for example, it's not hard to think of the example of the Boston attack. What if that had been a lot more? What if that had been 30 or 300 dead instead of 3? It's conceivable that somebody could have come up with that much explosives and set them off in a place with that many people around at some point, you know? Someone's really trying. Or think of the Times Square attack. I'm trying to think of the couple, or even the Detroit attack. What if the underpants bomber, what if that bomb had been put together better? What if it needed a button to be pushed instead of a fuse to be lit, you know? And he crashed, you know, had a plane explode over a major city, fall into its downtown area, and that kind of, you know, nightmare scenario. That could have been a really big deal. What if that had been successful? Of course, that attack was launched from Yemen. Just as the Americans were cracking down their drone war. In fact, Obama had really escalated the drone attacks in Yemen throughout November and December 2009, and then that attack took place on Christmas Day. And then they pretended that that attack was the first day of the world history here. Oh, look, we were just attacked by the bad guys in Yemen. We better start droning them now. Even though they'd been droning them for 2 months leading up to the attack. Same story, different day. And anyway, so at least this is getting through. Remember, when it was Leon Panetta, I forget if he was Secretary of Defense or head of the CIA at the time, but Leon Panetta was once asked by David Gregory, of all people. I know, David Gregory asking a question that value? Huh. And the question was, hey, Leon Panetta, we keep hearing these stories coming out of Yemen that every time we kill one guy, the bad guys get 10 new recruits who want to come and hurt us, so maybe this isn't working well. And Panetta's only answer, he couldn't deny it, that the blowback was worse than the bad guys, supposed bad guys, are identifying and killing. And his only answer was, hey, listen, these are the tools we have, and so we use them. Right? Like Chief Wiggum says, if you find yourself in a hole with a shovel, you got to start digging your way out of there. And deeper they go. Simple as that. That's what it means to be a government employee in charge of any department. And you already know that. It's the same damn thing when you're running a terror war. Well, these are the tools we have, so we're going to continue making everything worse deliberately, because what else are you going to do? Resign in disgrace? I don't know. Jump off a bridge? So, there we go. Insight. In Yemen, Al-Qaeda gained sympathy amid U.S. drone strikes. And it's just anecdote upon anecdote here. This one is from Reuters, but you won't have a hard time finding stories just like this from over the last, say, 3-4 years of people saying, man, I didn't even know where North America was, but you got a sworn enemy now. You know, just because of little things like killing their family members. It's amazing how that would, you know, engender feelings of hatred and yearnings toward revenge. Although, it doesn't seem that hard to figure out when you consider there are still people joining the U.S. Army in the name of the September 11th attack on this country from 12 years ago that didn't even affect anyone they know exactly or directly, you know? Same difference. And think about that. Did you ever have a wedding? Or you ever been in a wedding party for some people who are having one? It's supposed to be kind of a nice day, you know? Have somebody drop a Hellfire missile on you, kind of ruin that. A little ring bearer and bridesmaids and all that stuff. Come on, man. Uncles and aunts.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. Coming up, Marcy Wheeler, the brilliant genius. And also Jason Leopold, who, he's pretty sharp too. Writes for Al Jazeera America. And we'll be talking with them about things you could probably guess. Okay, but for now, to Iraq. Man, oh man. Al-Qaeda carving out a state in western Iraq. The Islamic State of Iraq borders Syria's Kurdistan, writes Jason Ditz, December 11th, 2013. Who would have thunk it, huh? Violence is on the rise region-wide, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq has its hands in much of it. The group's territorial possessions in Syria may be just the beginning, however, as they are now looking to establish another state in Iraq. A signpost in Iraq's western desert dubs the territory the Islamic State of Iraq, and the territory's relatively little tie to the Maliki government has them convinced that it's a claim they can enforce. With Al-Qaeda increasingly in control of northwestern Syria, the establishment of a second state in western Iraq presents a major challenge for both the Maliki government and the Syrian Kurds. Syrian Kurdistan ousted AQI from their territory in a series of decisive victories, but keeping them out looks to be a big challenge going forward, and dramatically more so if they border Kurdistan and both sides. This is likely to force Iraqi Kurdistan's hand in aiding them and furthering the regionalization of the war. And then, from original.antiwar.com/updates by Margaret Griffiths. This is from yesterday, the 16th of December. Iraq attacks against pilgrims, government buildings leave 100 dead and 183 wounded. And in fact, what it was just yesterday's story, I believe, was 37 killed, 62 wounded. Before that, the day before that, 34 killed, 43 wounded. The day before that, 22 killed, 30 wounded. 17 dead and 11 wounded. These are the archives, at least in double digits, every day bombings and shootings and attacks. And again, mostly by, well, the Sunni-based insurgency anyway. It's hard sometimes, the term Al-Qaeda, it is used overly broadly, but in some cases it's justified in the sense that if you think about how with your money, Petraeus basically showed up and bribed the Sunni-based insurgency to stop attacking the Americans, while they had already turned on the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, guys, the Islamic State of Iraq, they were calling themselves in. And this is post-Zarqawi, right? Zarqawi was killed at the beginning of 2006. And then if you go back and look, you can find stories from throughout 2006 where the local Iraqi insurgent, Sunni-based insurgency, was saying nuts to you guys, to the Zarqawiites, meaning mostly pretty much anybody from a foreign country who travel there to fight on the side of the Sunni-based insurgency, the Saudis, the Syrians, the Libyans, who traveled there to fight. And basically, they were so medieval in their tactics, you know, massacring Shiites at the marketplace and that kind of thing, instead of sticking to military targets. But also in the way that they were conscripting locals and enforcing, you know, ridiculous laws against smoking and that kind of thing, the same thing you see in Syria now. And the local Iraqis said, hey, look, you know, it's our insurgency. You're just here to help as long as we're asking. But now we're not asking for your help anymore. Beat it. You bother me. And if you don't hurry up and beat it, you're going to get shot. And that went on throughout 2006, where the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq was marginalizing the Al-Qaeda guys. But then again, you know, a lot of Iraqis have been recruited into the more fringe movements as well. And anyway, this is a major part of what they claimed was the surge working, was Petraeus showed up, and then beginning in 07, after a year of that already happening, he showed up and tried to take credit for the whole program by then giving money to those same Iraqi insurgents who had turned on the Al-Qaeda guys already. And, you know, pretending that he was paying them to do so. Well, then he went to war with Sadr and his forces for no reason whatsoever. and continued to fight a war to empower him in every other way at the same time. But anyway, so, you know, the Shiites won. The Americans helped the Shiites win, and then the Shiites led the Shiite Arabs in Iraq, led by Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister that America and Iran had compromised and agreed upon to put in power there from the Dawa Party, told the Americans, now beat it. Thanks a lot. Just like the Sunni insurgents had told al-Qaeda to beat it, their auxiliary shock troops, Maliki said, all right, thanks for fighting for me and putting the Shiites in power in Baghdad and sectarianly cleansing it so that now it's an 85% Shiite Arab city. Thanks a lot. Now get the hell out. We don't need you anymore. We're the majority, and we already won, so now go. And then, so that was the way things were, except this whole time, you know, since the Americans left the end of 2011, and even before then, Maliki's policy has been to tell the Sunnis to go to hell. You know, they had, by the Constitution, they had a Sunni vice president, but Maliki tried to have him arrested for crimes I'm sure he's probably guilty of. Running death squads on the Sunni side. But anyway, chased him right out of the country. And he's refused to share power with the Sunni Arabs at all. And so they're getting more and more radicalized, waiting for him. And then, so who are the ones, after all these years of warfare there, who are the people who are most likely to still be ready to fight? It's those whose beliefs are the most radical, and really, for that matter, those who are the youngest, right? You know? And so these are the very same people who've been picking up and heading off to Syria, not to live in a refugee camp, but heading off to Syria to go fight in the jihad against the Shiite Baathists in power in Damascus this whole time. And as Patrick Coburn's been telling us on this show for the last year and a half, this is sort of re-energized the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq. Because their idea is, hey, wait a minute. We're the majority in the region, the Sunni Arabs, and never mind these British-drawn borders, and backed by the Saudis, who can stop us? You know, their money. Why in the world should we settle? Let's take back Baghdad. I guess that's what they're trying to do now. And so, of course, America's on both sides, and losing all the way around, fighting in this war. We're still on the side of the Shiites and the Iranians in Iraq, while we're fighting more or less, it seems like we're still on the side of the al-Qaeda guys in Syria, as well as in Libya, while opposing them in Iraq. But then the Saudis are just cranking up their support for, I don't know, but we're not hearing much about what they're doing for the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq directly, but they sure are stepping up their financing of the al-Nusra Front up there in Syria. And now, I guess this is overly simplified, but the best I understand, I tried to get Patrick Coburn on the show today, but he couldn't do it. But he wrote this great piece at The Independent, a long-form piece here, Saturday the 14th of December, 2013. Britain's policy on Syria has just been sunk, and nobody noticed, and it might as well be, you know, the West's policy. And what it is that, and we talked about this with Daniel McAdams on the show yesterday, I hope you heard it, and the point being that the so-called moderates in Syria, who never really amounted to anything in the first place, they now have been completely run out of town. They're done. And the split now is between the al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda-ish guys, and the Islamic State of Iraq, and now they call themselves the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. You know what it is? It's the ridiculous lie of the Islamo-fascist caliphate that's coming to get us, coming to life in real life. That's what it is. George Bush was the most ridiculous, pathetic liar when he said there was anything like a new Sunni Islamist state on the rise in the world. It didn't exist, but he made it. It's the Sunni Triangle, the Anbar province, etc., up to Mosul, I guess. Sunni Arab Iraq split off in alliance with now rebel-held majority Sunni Syria. Parts of it anyway, not that they've taken the capital city, but... and it's funny because it used to always be that the irony there was that the only Islamo-fascist dictatorships of any kind you could point to in the region would be our loyal sock puppets, like the kingdoms in Jordan and Saudi Arabia, or the so-called president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, the different emirs and sultans and whatever they call themselves, potentates and His Highnesses and whatever the hell who rule throughout there. There's your Islamo-fascists, the American Empire's puppets. But here, they're actually creating terrorist land. You know, Bin Ladenite land. And it's American policy that's done it. George Bush, and then as he handed it off to... George Bush basically accidentally did this, I think, through sheer criminal negligence of the highest order. Not that he wasn't warned. And then Obama has continued the policy by backing the revolution in Syria. It's an amazing thing, you know. Assuming there's a future where historians write about this time, they're going to write things like, nobody knows what the hell they were doing at this time at all. And nobody at the time thought that they knew what they were doing either. And it was really stupid. What are they doing over there? It's incredible. I mean, it's not that funny because of all the dead people and all that, but otherwise, it's hilarious. Patrick Coburn, the West's policy on Syria has just been sunk. And now the split. Here's the split among the jihadist warriors that the West has been backing all along over there while trying to only back the other guys. The split is between the more Syrian al-Qaeda guys or the more Iraqi al-Qaeda guys and other foreigners who have traveled there. I guess the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or Iraq and Syria, however they call it. I guess that includes more of the Libyans and the Algerians and the Tunisians and the Chechens and the Afghans, who have traveled there to fight with the Iraqis in Syria, with the Sunnis. They're the ISIS or the ISIL types. And then I guess, supposedly, the al-Nusra guys are more Syrian. And yet, they're the ones who are now, at least in theory, being more backed by the Saudis, who are trying to isolate and marginalize the Iraqi types more. I don't know. That's what they're claiming. But so that's the only split, right? It'd be like, you know, it's a split between... it's analogous to a split between Zarqawiites and Bin Ladenites if we were talking about the Iraq War in 2005, right? Big difference. Not one. And of course, by that time, I guess Zarqawi had officially declared his loyalty to Bin Laden. In this case, the al-Nusra guys and the ISIL guys, they have long since declared their loyalty to Zawahiri. The only fight between them was the exact chain of command between them and him. And their goals are the same: to kill Shiites and Christians and to overthrow the government in Damascus, and then, you know, if they feel it's necessary, I guess, continue waging war against the West. Although I would argue that September 11th worked perfectly from the point of view of the terrorists who did it, that they don't really need to attack America anymore. It's not like the attack was just to punish us or just to hurt us out of anger and revenge. It was a tactic in a war. It was a big smack in the face to then lure you into their neighborhood to try to finish the fight, and then they finish it by just wearing us out. And then the theory would be, and this is what, you know, Michael Scheuer, the CIA's Bin Laden unit chief, said all along was their plan, to bleed us to bankruptcy. And then by forcing us all the way out of the region, then they could fight all their local revolutions. Well, it's already worked. I mean, really, you know, look at al-Qaeda's goals there. to bankrupt the Americans, to radicalize the population of the region and delegitimize the dictators and potentates of the region, and to gain power for themselves. Now, it used to be, I would say, almost all of that happened. The only place where bin Laden failed is, you know, he was a loser hiding in his attic at the time they finally found and executed him. He never won the power for himself, but he certainly achieved the rest of his goals, radicalizing the entire region, destabilizing every state in the region. And not in the least, by making the Americans break the bank and inflate the currency, which of course leads to inflation of everybody else's currency too, because they all the different central banks try to keep up with the inflation in order to keep the trade balances in line and all of that kind of thing. And so everybody living on a dollar a day found it's worth 50 cents and started rioting. And of course, they saw after all that bloodshed and all the dishonesty in the region, it's impossible for any population over there now to imagine that their governments are anything less than the sock puppet dictatorships that the Americans have chosen for them after the entire occupation of Iraq. So Al-Qaeda achieved virtually everything. And this is the thing that I think a lot of 9/11 truther types miss. And I think, you know, hey, maybe the Republicans wanted that thing to happen. Maybe they hired Prince Bandar to make sure it happened. But in taking advantage of it, they were still falling for it. That was the whole goal, was to trick the Republicans into taking advantage of it. Look at it from the point of view of bin Laden and Zawahiri. They were frustrated by Bill Clinton's wimpiness. Bill Clinton didn't want to get bogged down over there. Everybody made fun of him for just shooting cruise missiles. And even I would criticize him for not sending the military to kill bin Laden on a few occasions when he had the chance to. But what he didn't want to do was invade anything and get too bogged down in the fight. But as bin Laden's son told Rolling Stone back in the summer of 2010... bin Laden was thrilled when the Republicans took power in the year 2000, 2001, when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney came in. Couple of pretend tough guys. The softest hands in the West. And they were going to obviously exploit the 9/11 attack in every way they possibly could. For the money and for the power in every way that they could. For whoever's agenda could get in on the act with them. And they could. And that was easy as hell to see coming. And that was part of the plan. That's the whole point. The action is in the reaction. And so, you know, I don't know why any of these terrorists would want to come to America and kill Americans anymore, except maybe just for revenge and punishment. But as far as the actual tactic goes in the war, they've already achieved what they wanted. And it will be a long time for the American Empire to completely withdraw from the Middle East. That may take a real breaking of the bank, not just a figurative one. But I think it's agreed by every analyst on Earth from every, you know, state, including this one, that American power and influence in the Middle East is broken and for all time, and it's all downhill from here as far as that goes. It's all very much worked to the advantage. And, I mean, seriously, think about it. Bin Laden was still alive, hiding in his attic in Pakistan right now, and he was watching the war in Syria. What would he think? You know? I think they were disappointed by the Arab Spring at first, probably. Like, hey, here's a bunch of kids in Gap shirts protesting for democracy. This isn't quite the revolution we had in mind. But then, yeah, all that fell apart. The Americans aren't going to let there be any democracy over there. And now anybody who's willing to really resist would be the hardcore and the most radical, right? Like in Egypt right now, who's fighting except the toughest gangs out of the Sinai Peninsula? But other than that, the Muslim Brotherhood, they're not at war. They've been thrown out of power by the military there, and they're pretty much done. What are they going to do? Nothing. Only the craziest. The kinds of guys that Hamas finds and kills when they crop up in the West Bank. I mean, in the Gaza Strip. Only those guys are willing to die in the suicide missions, you know? But anyway, It just seems like, I don't know, generation upon generation of people who are willing to die in suicide attacks or, you know, equally hazardous activities. It's playing with a lot of fire. In fact, as Patrick Coburn was saying, you know, if the war in Syria quits working out for them as a theater of operations for them to go and be jihadists in, that might be when they turn west. Now what are we going to do? Our government has brought these guys from the edge of no man's land on the Durand line, the British drawn line between Afghanistan and Pakistan back in 2001, and brought them all the way, not just to Iraq, but all the way into Syria now. Which means, you know, it could mean access to the Mediterranean Sea, right? It could mean, I don't know, I'm not saying Damascus is going to fall. It doesn't look like it's going to, but it could. Then what? And you know what's funny about all this, too? Israel. Because Michael Oren, the outgoing, he's gone now, I guess a few months ago, he was the outgoing Israeli ambassador to the United States, and he was in the Jerusalem Post saying, oh, of course, we prefer Al-Qaeda to Hezbollah. And Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah might both be bad, but Hezbollah's backed by Iran. So if Hezbollah is on the side of the Syrian government, then we prefer that Al-Qaeda win. Whoa. Pretty blatant. And then, just recently, one of the former heads of the Israeli Mossad contradicted that and said, no, we actually prefer Assad. Which, come on, if you're being the Israelis for a moment, pretending, you would have to prefer Assad on your northern border to a bunch of suicide bomber bin Ladenites, right? They'd be crazy to prefer Al-Qaeda to Hezbollah. They would be out of their minds to prefer Al-Qaeda to the Syrian government. Well, apparently they finally have realized that. And it was seemingly, I don't know the correlation, causation, relationship exactly, but it was after that. It was after one of the former heads of Mossad started sounding like me on that. Was when Michael Hayden came out and some of the other people. Ryan Crocker. Was it Ryan Crocker or Nicholas Burns? One of these former State Department guys. Was quoted in the New York Times saying, yeah, you know, at this point, I think we're going to have to start to prefer Assad went out in the end. Really? You know, you'd think there was a reason that George Bush and Dick Cheney hired Assad to torture Al-Qaeda guys for them for 8 years, including innocent people. But anyway, yeah, anybody looking for a grand design in American foreign policy, good luck. I think actually it's just a contest. Dare to be stupid. Like some kind of, you know, thing that you do in the backyard at a birthday party or something, you know? So you can be more like Johnny Knoxville. Isn't he the guy that crashes all the time in the Camp Kill Yourself? Back in my day, they called it Camp Kill Yourself. I don't know what it is now. Jackass is what it is. All right. But there you go. Oh, and by the way, I think it's important to note Seymour Hersh last week came out with this thing in the London Review of Books, and Robert Perry, who I have a grudge against, but Robert Perry wrote a thing following up in Consortium News, Fresh Doubts About Syria's Sarin Guilt. I guess I'm really waiting for Gareth. Put out an all-points bulletin for Gareth Porter. Gareth says straight about all the different HRW and UN reports and Seymour Hersh reports and all the different reports at the reports about who gassed who in Syria with what. There's been quite a bit of criticism of the Hersh piece, and I'm not sure all of it's warranted, but I do suspect that some of it is. But then again, I'm reading the Perry piece, and the Perry piece, again, consortiumnews.com, Fresh Doubts About Syria's Sarin Guilt, he's now referring to the renewed United Nations report and how it's being misreported in the New York Times, etc. But what it really says is that the UN is backing down from their previous conclusions about what was in some of the shells, whether they had even proof of sarin in one of these attacks at all or not. And anyway, it would be easy for me to say, well, they just faked the whole thing. Or, well, it's obvious that the al-Nusra Front did it as a false flag attack to get it, you know, to give the Democrats an excuse to attack Assad or this, that, or the other. I can't say for certain like that. But I think this is all you need to know, really, is that according to Philip Giraldi, and in fact, there were other sources along these lines, too. And Hirsch talks about this as well in his piece at the London Review of Books. There was major dissension inside the CIA about whether they were going to conclude that Assad had done this. Remember, at the time, we covered on the show how this was sort of a fraudulent CIA report. It looked like a CIA report, but it didn't quack like one. It was written to sound like the things that they would say, oh, we judge with high confidence this, and we determine that, and whatever. But actually, it was clearly a political document, a White House product, and that, Gareth Porter immediately deduced correctly, meant that the CIA wouldn't put one out that said what the White House wanted it to say. They refused. Philip Giraldi then followed up and with a piece at the American Conservative magazine saying that there was a big fight and there were CIA analysts who were going to resign. A number of them were going to resign all at once over these assertions if somebody tried to make them put their names on these conclusions, these supposed conclusions about Assad doing this attack. So it sure sounds to me like regardless of whether Assad really did do it, whether all the information now bears that out or not, I'm not certain, although I suspect that's not the case. But regardless, the CIA was being pushed for political reasons to make conclusions that their professional analysts were not prepared to make, did not want to make, and they refused to do so. And then, you know, why Obama backed down, I'm not certain, but I think that I think Ray McGovern has got it. Has got the best explanation so far, and that is that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff not only told Obama, don't do it, he said, if any reporters ask me why you did it, I'll tell them I told you not to, so it's going to be all on you. And it was at that point that the president backed down. Again, thank God. All right, we'll be right back with Jason Leopold in a sec.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. Hey, I keep forgetting to mention, I finally got the Amazon thingamajig up and running where if you want to go and buy your books by way of my site, I'll get a cut. So you know how that works with the anti-war bookstore, LouRockwell.com, or a lot of people have an affiliate program there with Amazon. Doesn't raise your price any. It just means I get a cut of what you spend at Amazon.com. So if you do all your Christmas shopping or anything like that on Amazon.com, just go to ScottHorton.org. Oops, I forgot to mute my phone today, so it sounds like baking cookies over here. Hang on. if you go to scotthorton.org and you look in the right-hand margin, then you will see a big Amazon.com logo. Click on that, and then anything that you buy after that, I'll get a little bit of a kickback. And then I can get Christmas presents for people that I like, too. Wouldn't that be cool? All right. So, ScottHorton.org. Just look in the right-hand margin there for the link. Also, you can find it on my Facebook page, too, if you want. All right. Anyway, so now we get to talk with Jason Leopold, intrepid reporter on the Guantanamo beat, mostly these days, and he is writing for Al Jazeera America, and that is america.aljazeera.com. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
Doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me back on.
Good to have you here. And so you just got back from Guantanamo Bay, right? How long were you there?
I was there for a week. I was there last week, just returned on Saturday, and I was basically down there check out the facilities again, take another prison tour, speak with some of the new military personnel who were recently deployed there in October, also to get a sort of insight and as much as possible into what the state of affairs is with regard to a hunger strike.
Yeah, well, and you got a lot of great journalism here at america.aljazeera.com. I want to tell people about here. We've got Marooned at Guantanamo. We've got New Guantanamo Commander Supports Closing Facility. Gitmo Media Blackout Hopes to Undermine Hunger Strikers. And Gitmo Officials Change Procedures for Hunger Strikes Force Feeding. And, of course, as just referred to, the process for disclosing what's going on with the hunger strike behind the scenes. You want to start with that?
And there's also a story up there about some of the items you can buy at the gift shop at Guantanamo, and the sort of whole surreal experience about hearing Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville as I'm traveling over to the prison.
Well, you know what? I don't want to spend too much time on that, but actually, I think it is probably kind of important to set the scene about what you call the surreal nature of the Guantanamo base surrounding this notorious prison.
Yeah, I mean, it's I probably mentioned this to you before, but Guantanamo is it's an active naval base. It's 45 square miles, resembles a small town, and in fact, the prison itself is on a far corner of the island, in a real desolate area. It's not accessible to anyone who works there unless you have a specific clearance. So you can't just sort of say, I'm going to drive over to the prison side. But the rest of Guantanamo, which is sort of, the folks that are there on the Navy side just sort of go about their business and seem to forget and are oblivious to the fact that, you have this prison there. I mean, during the week that I was there, they were preparing for Christmas. So you have this this big Christmas tree as you're driving up sort of the main road, these holiday lights that say season's greetings from Guantanamo Bay, gingerbread houses, gingerbread Santa Claus, Frosty the Snowman out there. And so it's just surreal because, you are at Guantanamo. And then, of course, you go into the gift shop and every T-shirt that they have there, describing Guantanamo as this coastal paradise. They did have one T-shirt that said, Joint Task Force Guantanamo, detainee operations, Operation Enduring Freedom. So, I'm not sure who would wear such a shirt, but, they have a T-shirt commemorating the fact that they do have a prison there.
Well, and listen, I mean, you got to admit, it all is very normal now. I mean, there was a time where that was sort of all of what you're describing there would be the most normal thing about it, as though, somehow that kind of fake hometown feeling that they build up around it is meant to try to force a feeling of normalization about what's actually taking place. But at this point, it's worked, I think, and it is all very normal, not because of the town that they built up there or that already existed there to a great degree, I understand, but not because of that, but just because it's been so long that we've had this, more or less legal black hole. I mean, you couldn't really consider the laws that they've passed legalizing this after the fact to be legit, I don't think, It's all very
ad hoc. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's been 12 years. January will be 12 years since the first prisoners were brought to Guantanamo. And in fact, this month marks 12 years, actually, since when John Yoo, the former Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel attorney, wrote a memo, actually, to the Defense Department, more or less explaining why Guantanamo was the best place to hold, you know, so-called enemy combatants. And essentially, you know, he said it's outside of the law. They won't have a right to habeas corpus. So, you know, he was proved wrong years later. But, you know, many anniversaries coming up. And, you know, just the fact, as I indicated, you know, being there, you don't expect to get much when you're there, Scott, but it's, you know, it's important. I wanted to talk to the medical staff, really wanted to, you know, get an opportunity to, you know, once again, see the facilities. I was able to observe some, you know, some prisoners in the compliant camp, you know, which they call Camp 6. That's the camp where you have to eat food. And if you don't eat food, you get sent over to Camp 5, which is the non-compliant camp. So, you know, it's always amazing to me to sort of take a walk through these, you know, through these through the cell blocks, and there's no, you know, they brought me through a cell block where there's no, you know, it wasn't an active cell block, no prisoners that are there, but you know, looking at the cells that they have spent, you know, 12 years in, nearly 12 years, most of them, it's unbelievable.
But then they still wouldn't let you anywhere near any of the detainees at all.
Well, they actually did. I mean, you know, I was standing outside of, or I was facing, you know, some of the prisoners behind a one-way glass. So I was able to, you know, observe them in Camp 6 in this communal block as they were, you know, watching television, eating lunch.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Breakfast. You say that. They got headphones on. That means they're watching TV. They're plugged into the thing.
Right. So so I did get to see them. And I'll tell you, you know, many of them look, they just look old. They look old. They look weak. I tried to really sort of study their faces to see if I could, you know, figure out who's who. That was difficult because, you know, they're obviously moving around. And having the opportunity to speak to some of the guards, you know, one guard telling me that, you know, he's ready to go home. He wants to get the heck out of there. Guantanamo's not for him. You know, the staff is constantly sort of emphasizing how, you know, the challenges that they face, you know, trying to impress upon me. I was the only media there that week, by the way. But they're trying to impress upon me that the, you know, they're constantly splashing them and assaulting the guard force with, you know, a cocktail of feces, urine. It's, you know, and then just trying to get an idea of what, you know, what the operations are like, what the hunger strike has been like, whether there's an ongoing hunger strike. Those were the difficult questions. Those were the questions that I just could not get an answer to. You know, and speaking with the even with the medical staff, I mean, they just spoke in clinical terms, you know, calling it an e-feeding. I actually have not heard that before, e-feeding, as opposed to force feeding. Hunger strike was self-fast, you know, and they're unconcerned about the criticism that, you know, ethical groups have laid out, you know, with regard to the force feeding. But I will tell you that, you know, while there's these discussions taking place here in the U.S. about Guantanamo and whether or not it will be closed, and we just saw, as a matter of fact, you know, two prisoners were released over the weekend. Right as I was leaving, you know, apparently they released two prisoners back to Saudi Arabia. There's no discussion like that at Guantanamo, Scott. So everyone there is they won't discuss the possibility of the, you know, the prison closing down. They'll only say, you know, we're focused on the mission. We're focused on the mission. In fact, in that story where I've got sort of the photographs there with the T-shirts, I picked up while I was there, you know, one of these smart cards that the public relations staff carries around. And basically, I'm able to understand now why certain questions aren't answered, because on the smart card, it contains all the talking points. You know, what can be talked about and what cannot be discussed with the media. So it was certainly surreal being there. I think it was, you know, again, it's just important. You know, having the opportunity to sort of, you know, be a bit aggressive in my reporting, trying to get the trying to get some questions answered. And, you know, for example, as you know, they recently withheld, they're no longer providing the media with a figure of how many prisoners are on hunger strike. Mm-hmm. And I was able to at least get them to admit that the reason they're not doing that anymore is because the prisoners were very successful in attracting media attention, which was ultimately the main goal, you know, to try to raise awareness about a hunger strike. I mean, that's, you know, I don't particularly see anything wrong with that, with trying to get media attention. But the fact that they did, attract so much attention, now they're withholding those numbers.
Right, and they're pretty honest about that anyway, right? That, well, see, it was working, so we had to stop.
Yes, they were. They're very forthcoming. You know, the head of public affairs who I spoke with there, Commander John Philostrat, said, you know, it's a self-perpetuating story. We don't want to feed into that. We don't want to give them an opportunity to sort of. We don't want to help them attract the media attention by giving me or anyone else any figures about the number of hunger strikers,
right.
Because you know they felt that, you know, what happens? What will you know, what will you do with that information? Well, you'll go out and you'll write a story. And that story will just, you know, it will just constantly every day we'll hear about the number of hunger strikers. And, you know, it's so funny because they claim, you know, one of the taglines there is transparency. Safe, humane, legal, transparent. That's the actual tagline of Joint Task Force Guantanamo Operation, mm-hmm. Or the motto. And they've been anything but transparent. You know, one of the things, if you'll notice in some of these pictures I took, you're not allowed to shoot, you're not allowed to take photographs of anyone's faces. So I could not take a photograph, except unless they give you permission. So I was not able to take a picture of, for example, the head of the hospital or the officer in charge of the, you know, detainee hospital showing his face. He did allow me to use his name. So after, and I also was able to speak to a guard who allowed me to use his name and photograph him. But after I left, I found out that they implemented, literally when I left, Scott, I mean, I'm still on the plane, back to the U.S., they implemented a new policy now that no one can speak on the record or have their picture taken, even if they volunteer, because of the fear that, security concerns that something can happen to them or their families by being associated with prison operations.
Yeah, well, they're just projecting their guilt, and that's kind of understandable.
Right, yeah.
Putting these guys in, you know, in a sense, there's at least a kernel of truth there, right, that they're putting these guys in danger like that. Now, so the numbers, I think you said in the article, you are led to believe there are 29 people who are still hunger striking now, basically, correct?
Well, that's actually the figure that comes from Shakar Amer, who is the last, UK prisoner still in Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, during the hunger strike, what was happening all year? I mean, basically, we received our information about, you know, how many prisoners were on hunger strike from the attorneys who received it from the prisoners. So once it got to the point where, you know, that they were sort of driving, you know, the news cycle by, that's when the Guantanamo official stepped in. So once they stopped reporting those numbers, Shakar Amer spoke to his attorney, Clive Stafford Smith, of Reprieve, and said that there, you know, the Guantanamo hunger strike is back on. And there's now, 29, you know, prisoners on hunger strike and, 19 being forced out.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I don't know if maybe this is kind of beyond your purview as a journalist about this, but you may have an opinion. It seems like, in a sense, they're really asking for the right to commit suicide here. And when you talk to the doctor in your article, his thing is, hey, man, I only have one job, and that is keeping them healthy. And any other consideration about why it is that they're choosing starving themselves to death as a form of protest or whatever, that's beyond their purview to even think about. That's just not even a question. But that's really the right that this officer is denying them, is their right to go that far in trying to make their point about being held indefinitely without charges like this, correct?
Exactly, yes. I mean, that's, you've nailed it. And it's, you know, as I indicated, you know, taking a look at these cells, which are, you know, 10 by 7, I believe. I mean, Scott, there, you know, some of these cells there, you know, there aren't any windows in there. You know, the lights are either very bright, very dim. It's a climate-controlled setting. You know, it's
And to be told over and over that, yeah, you've been cleared for release, but we're never going to release you. You're going to die here, too.
Right.
You haven't been charged with any crime, much less convicted of one, but we're still not. Oh, and we agree with you that you never did anything, but we're still not letting you go.
Right, and if we do let you go, you know, you're going to have to go to a rehab center, even though we never, you know, we were never able to prove you did anything.
All right.
So,
hold it right there, Jason. We got to take this break, unfortunately.
Sure.
But we'll be right back, everybody, with Jason Leopold right after this. Go to america.aljazeera.com. He's got a great series here from his recent trip down to Guantanamo Bay. More like this on the other side of the break.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
All right, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm talking with Jason Leopold. He's now writing for america.aljazeera.com. And just back from Guantanamo Bay, he's got, what, five or six very important stories here. And can we talk a minute? We're talking about the force feeding and the protest by suicide here. It occurs to me that maybe some of these guys, if they knew that they were really that the Americans would let them actually starve themselves all the way to death, they might start eating anyway, right? It becomes easier for them to protest when they know that they're not really going to die of it. But then again, it seems like it should be up to them to decide that, considering the situation that they're in, you know?
Sure. I think that, I think that a hunger strike in general is, you know, is aimed at trying to attract attention and to raise awareness. And that's certainly what this hunger strike did. I don't believe that, you know, these prisoners were just, you know, deciding not to eat. Perhaps some of them were just, you know, so they can die.
It's going to take that to make their point, because nothing short of that is going to do it, I'm afraid.
Well, exactly. I think that, you know, there probably are some that would, look, you know, they don't have the ability, apparently, even though one last year is said to have, you know, overdosed. But it is the only control that they have over their, you know, or one would think over their bodies. But now we're basically seeing, well, no, actually it isn't. So, you know, the hunger strike was hugely successful, Scott, in raising awareness and getting President Obama to actually note it during a major counterterrorism speech. It probably, you know, resulted. It's probably the reason that we've seen, you know, the results of renewed efforts to attempt to close the prison. It's there's no question in my mind, at least, that, you know, the hunger strike is what ultimately led this administration to, you know, release, I think it's about four or five prisoners in the past, month or two. It's still very slow. So, you know, as a form of protest, as what it was originally intended, it succeeded. You know, at this point, I think that, you know, if they knew that, you know, that, or if there was a change in policy where, you know, suddenly they were allowed to starve themselves to death, sure, I think maybe some of them would, you know, would start eating again. But I also think that there are some that would, you know, you'd see mass deaths there as a result. And how would that look? So we know that's never going to happen, Scott. They're never going to allow that to happen.
Yeah. Well, and then the alternative is torturing them, basically. I mean, I think it's interesting the way in your interview he goes to great pains. The, I guess, doctor or officer of some type there goes to great lengths to try to explain that, oh, when it comes to cramming the tube down their throat and force feeding them, they're all very submissive and compliant, and we use olive oil, and they seem to really like that. And so
I'm
trying to take the torture out of the force feeding, but it is, in essence, a pretty severe process, right?
It is. I mean, it's and I asked that question last time I was there in May, and you know, the doctor was very, the senior medical officer, that's how I was only able to refer to him. I mean, he was very upset, very very defensive, you know, to at any suggestion that this was, you know, that this was torture. And you know, the doctor, or rather the nurse who I spoke with, who mentioned the olive oil, and it's you know, had said to me that, you know, this is a procedure that he's done dozens of times, you know, in the U.S. at hospitals. And I said to him, so what's the difference? You know, I was hoping that he would sort of, you know, he was saying, well, it's not really, you know, any difference. But, you know, in a hospital setting where someone needs to be force-fed, you know, they're not going against their will. It's perhaps they're, you know, they're having digestive issues or whatever the medical issues are that, you know, require them to have a tube, you know, snake down their, you know, into their nose, down to their stomach. Here, you know, it clearly is different. And yet they just would not, could not sort of see that. Although the senior medical officer this time around did say, well, they do sort of resist when they're being placed into the restraint chair. But yeah, you know, then they'll accept it once they're in there. It's, you know, it's odd. It's how do we even react to that? And then again, where, you know, the doctors are saying, you know, this is, you know, we're just focusing on the mission. We're just following orders. I don't even think it's the new normal. It's just what's normal at Guantanamo, you know.
Like the KFC a mile away is exactly what it is. This is just how we do business, same as always, to them.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and then the other problems here, though, as I indicated in that same story, Scott, is that, you know, you have now prisoners who are aging, you know, and then this indefinite detention, solitary confinement, hunger strikes. I mean, it's taken a toll on their, not just their mental health and physical health, but it's resulting in, you know, in serious ailments. So, you know, last week when I was there, you know, two prisoners were getting ready to undergo cataract surgery, and you know, they had to fly in, you know, a physician to perform the surgery because we still have a provision in the National Defense Authorization Act that says that they cannot come to the U.S., even come to the U.S. For, you know, for medical reasons. So, you know, all this money is being spent, you know, to, at this point, to start flying physicians in, you know, every 60 to 90 days to perform some type of procedure because they just won't allow them to come, you know, come to the U.S. I mean, it's strange. It's truly strange, but this is you know, the pace that you know, that's continuing to go. You know, at this point we have 160 there. There's supposed to be two prisoners actually being released tomorrow, by the way.
Yeah,
that's the news.
I saw a couple, as you mentioned, a couple were let go, sent back to Algeria. To Algeria. To Algeria.
Yeah, the last Sudanese, you know, prisoners there are supposed to be released tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So that will bring it down to 158. And,
well, I'm sure you're aware of the first commander, the Marine officer who was, I forget if he was a general or corporal or captain or whatever, but lieutenant, some. Anyway, he's come out
commander.
Against it, and he was on CNN actually just before the show saying that he knew then that a lot of these people did not deserve to be there at all in the first place. And that is the consensus now, and they still won't finish closing it down and letting the innocent go free and figuring out a way to convict the guilty in a federal court, which ought to be easy enough anyway. I mean, come on, all they got to do is show up to get a conviction against Ramzi Bin al-Shib. So, anyway, there's the consensus as you're reporting here. The admiral who's in charge now, he agrees with everybody says they want to close it, and yet here we are still. But at least we got you to read. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
That's Jason Leopold, everybody. America.aljazeera.com for his latest series from his trip to Guantanamo Bay.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
EmptyWheel.net. That's where you read Marcy Wheeler. EmptyWheel.net. And you can follow her on Twitter as well. The brightest mind in bloggerdom that we got. And we've got big news to cover here on the NSA scandal, the endlessly developing National Security Agency scandal. Welcome back to the show, Empty Wheel. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us. So, the big news is that a federal judge named Leon, well, he ruled something yesterday on the grounds of this, the Verizon, the original big NSA story, right? The metadata program. What did he rule?
He basically issued an injunction forbidding the NSA from using the phone data of the two plaintiffs, one of whom was Larry Klayman from Judicial Watch, another one of whom is the father of an NSA guy who was tied to the SEAL Team 6. So those are the plaintiffs. NSA can't use their data, but then he stayed his injunction against the NSA pending appeal. So it has no immediate legal effect. But what he said was, you guys are using a law from 1979 to authorize this dragnet when the way phones are used in this day and age bears no resemblance to the way they were used back in 1979. And on that basis, I think these guys are probably going to succeed in the lawsuit, and therefore I'm going to tell you to stop.
Right. So, in other words, he's saying, hey, I'm just a lowly federal judge here, and this is going to be decided at a higher level than me anyway, but I'm ruling that I believe that you'll be successful at that higher level. So he stayed his own injunction, but he did, as you put it, break the ice and get it on the record that somebody in charge of judging the law has judged that it is being misapplied here.
Right, right. I mean, I think there are competing opinions out there on whether or not the D.C. Circuit will overturn this on appeal. And, you know, I think there are aspects of Leon's decision that aren't as strong as they could be, but we'll see what happens on appeal. I'm not going to, and as a number of people have pointed out, that we finally have three Obama appointees, two of whom are fairly conservative, one of whom is less conservative. So, you know, who knows what's going to happen at the D.C. Circuit, but at the very least, as you said, everyone is now talking about the phone dragnet differently because, after a bunch of judges in secret have said, yeah, this is okay, in kind of ridiculous legal reviews, he said, no, it's not. And so, no longer, for example, can Dianne Feinstein go out there and say, this is legal, this is legal, this is legal. Now she's saying only the Supreme Court can call this unconstitutional. She's trying to say that Leon's opinion doesn't matter, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far it does matter a bit. Now, so take us back to this thing from 1979, you said, I believe, the Smith versus Maryland. It's not quite a law. It's a court ruling about the PIN register data, right, is the one you're talking about?
Yeah. Basically, the court back in 1979 said that in pursuing this crook, the government could get his phone records, and we're talking weeks of phone records, not forever, to find out who he had been talking to. So, there's not only do we use phones differently, not only does the rise of cell phones change things significantly, we're talking about a very limited period of phone records in that case, and we're talking about records in perpetuity for people against whom there's no suspicion in the phone dragnet.
But now they try to pretend that this is the hugest loophole in the whole wide world, that if anybody ever tells anyone else anything, or at least they do business with someone where they have to share information with that business, it now becomes no longer protectable or considered private from government use that would require a warrant. But that couldn't possibly be right, right? It sort of seems to me like I don't really understand how they got away with that decision even back in 79, that this guy's records, I saw in a comment section somewhere that, so does that mean that if Alexander Hamilton had sent a piece of paper with a courier to the other side of town, that he would have been given up his right to keep his papers private? Even Hamilton wouldn't have gone along with that, and he was the very worst one out of all of them, right?
And they're making if Hamilton put it into an envelope, then they would say Hamilton didn't give over the contents of that letter. He gave over the contents of the address. And that's the basis, but you're right. I mean, it's called the third party doctrine. And on that basis, it's not just phone records the government can get without much review. It's also things like email metadata they used for years. It's financial information. You know, they're using cookies to track us, same kind of thing. So if Leon's decision holds, the fundamental notion that the third-party doctrine is outdated, then it's going to change a lot of things about surveillance, but it's too early to see what's going to happen. And effectively, you're going to get at least one or two circuit splits by the time it gets to the Supreme Court, and that's when things will change.
Right. All right, and then I read on your blog that part of what the judge brought up was the so-called special needs doctrine that says that, well, if it's, really an emergency, they can do whatever they want. And he was saying, you haven't really shown that this is really an emergency, that we need this program this bad, that it would somehow justify, obvious widespread violations of the spirit and letter of the Fourth Amendment.
Right. And he was getting further down the chain of legal analysis. So he said, Smith v. Maryland doesn't hold. And so I'm going to do kind of a brand new Fourth Amendment review of this program. And the significance of the special needs is that we know the government is using it for other things, like the PRISM, for example. They're using a special needs argument in that case as well. And I think the phone dragnet is a much harder case to justify than PRISM for its value. So I'm not going to say that ruling that the phone dragnet isn't all that useful doesn't have any effect on PRISM, but it is remarkable in that the judge said, okay, I'm in a position where I can weigh the privacy interests of these plaintiffs against the efficacy of this program in finding terrorists. And since you've never found a terrorist, much less a terrorist you needed to find quickly, I don't think the program has been all that valuable in accomplishing the goals you claim it serves to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Even that seems like a pretty dangerous kind of standard, though, but I guess that's always the way that justification is always a gray scale to be decided by them, right? When it comes to
this is another Supreme Court precedent that's out there and has been expanded just like the third party doctrine has. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it justifies a lot of surveillance. It also justifies drunk driving stops, the random driver stops that they sometimes put up. Mm-hmm. But I do think if it looks like his decision is going to stand, you're going to find as much squawking about the fact that a judge can assess whether these programs are useful, because that's what the intelligence community refuses to even really let the intelligence committees do. You know, they say they're the executive branch and they get to decide what's useful. And so even if they've never, ever found an actual terrorist with this program, they're still going to keep sweeping up all of our communications because they say they have to.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now, so one of the things that we talked about before is how this has changed the terms of the debate a little bit, even though it's sort of he issued an injunction and then, in a way, overruled his own, turning it on or use of it, that kind of thing, that he's broken the ice, and right away Glenn Greenwald and others claimed vindication for Ed Snowden, and it seems like that narrative is even getting through on TV as well, that... Well, gee whiz, maybe that young man really did have a point, according to this court's ruling. So, do you think that's going to change very much in terms of the conversation going forward from here?
Look, I think it's not just that. I mean, I think you've got the tech companies saying you've gone too far. You've got the president kind of making wobbly gestures in that direction because he doesn't want to piss off his buddies, the tech execs. Mm-hmm. You've got more disclosures, and some disclosures that are really troubling about the way that NSA makes us less safe and they're stealing stuff overseas when they... So, I mean, there's the weight of all of the disclosures. But, yeah, I think it matters that a judge has said Edward Snowden was right in finding this program beyond the bounds of the Constitution. It's just one judge. We're going to see a lot of other judges weigh in before this is done, but... we've got legal experts now saying that Edward Snowden had a point when he leaked that.
Mm-hmm. And now, I'm lazy, I didn't read the thing, but is it right that he invoked George Orwell and James Madison and all these things and really kind of went off in this opinion?
Yeah, it's a pretty good read for anybody who ever can tolerate legal opinions. I mean, he does say that Madison would be aghast, and he talks about the Orwellian size of this dragnet. So he's pretty pissed off, not just about the fact that they're claiming it, but, you know, I just think that he sees that the government has been less than honest about what they're doing and the scope of it. And so he's not particularly patient with the government in the first place. And then he does find the program itself pretty offensive.
Mm-hmm. And then can you talk a little bit more about the tech giants complaints here that you mentioned?
Well, the tech giants have issued a reform proposal. A lot of what they want more control. I mean, here's the thing. Back in 2007 and 2008, the government passed first the Protect America Act and then the FISA Amendments Act. And those are the things that underlie what we know as PRISM, which means that the government goes through the FBI, actually, but the government can go and get large swaths of data from these internet companies with the approval of the FISA court. And they did that in 2007 and 2008 because before that point, the telecoms had just been stealing from the tech companies, stealing from Google and Yahoo and Microsoft and giving the data free. I mean, well, I don't know whether it was free, but giving the data to the government. So the tech companies, I mean, the telecoms, AT&T, stealing stuff off their circuits and giving it to the government. And the tech companies were legitimately really pissed about that. So they passed this law, which is supposed to fix that problem, that now the government, rather than going to AT&T to get them to steal the data from the tech companies just turn it over. And the tech companies want some limits on what they have to turn over. It sounds like the requests they've been getting has been expanding and expanding. But the other thing that they want to prevent is they want to prevent the government doing what one of the disclosures at the Washington Post said they were doing, which is going into the cables between their own servers. So basically going in with data in motion, which there are legal, legal significance to that. But they basically were stealing the data from Google now rather than stealing it from AT&T as they were doing before 2007. And so that, you know, rightly, I think, really pissed off the tech companies because, you know, you've got legal means to get what the courts believe you should be able to get. So why are you going overseas in addition to steal the data? Right. And we don't know exactly why they're doing that. So the tech companies are complaining. Obama's feeling a little bit of pressure from that. And because of that, it adds a higher likelihood that the Leahy Sensenbrenner, it's called the Freedom Act, will pass Congress because, you know, Congress people listen to corporations a lot more than they listen to us mere people.
That's
the stink, is they you know, it's beginning to really, really hurt their business model. They thought that they had some kind of legal framework in which they, you know, this all had some kind of overview, and all that's gone out the window. So they're pissed, and they're right to be pissed.
Mm-hmm. And now, well, I guess I'm just speculating, but doesn't it seem like the reason that they were going through and breaking into the cloud structure and all that of, and stealing from Google what they could have asked for was because that's their loophole around, first of all, having to use the law, and instead, as you're always talking about, invoking Executive Order 12333, which is their magic get away with doing anything that you weren't allowed to get away with under the other laws, and that's their way that they can incidentally gather up everything about the Americans that they're not allowed to get other than going and specifically asking for it if they go the other routes, right?
Yeah, we don't know exactly why they're doing it, but we know... You know, we know some reasons they might be doing it. I think, and I'm one of the few people who writes about this publicly, but I think the FISA court has actually imposed limits on what the government can go and get information from Google about. I think it's limited to terrorism, cybersecurity, and counterproliferation. So if the government wants to get it to spy on Airbus's executives, they can't get that directly from Google. They'll have to go steal it. So that's one possibility. You noted that there's a higher standard for what's called the minimization procedures for the things the government has to do to protect U.S. person data. Higher standard if it's done under FISA than if it's done under 12333. Mm-hmm. And so it is possible that they wanted to get U.S. person data that they couldn't get directly in the United States, and so they just went over and had GCHQ do it in England. Right. A lot of possibilities, none of them good, and there's, you know, an accumulating bits of evidence suggesting that NSA is increasingly doing this, going overseas when they hit up against legal barriers in the United States, and that would mean they're basically operating lawlessly again, and that would be a real issue of concern. We just need to prove that so that maybe... maybe Obama will get actually genuinely concerned as opposed to just, you know, at this point, I think, pretending to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, so you mentioned the Leahy Sensenbrenner bill, and I guess the way I understand it, that one is more of a reform than the Feinstein bill, which basically just codifies what they're already doing wrong. And you were talking about, you know, these tech giants getting in on it. I read a piece, I don't know whether IBM's lobbyists are doing this, that, or the other thing, maybe you know, but I read about how they're being sued by shareholders who are saying, hey, you didn't warn us that the NSA scandal had completely gutted your Asian revenue coming in, and how the Chinese have basically just kicked IBM out of everything over there and cost them bazillions of dollars, and their stock price plummeting and all of this stuff, and... Boy, somebody's got to have some political pull to push back. You know, why not IBM? If Google and Yahoo aren't big enough, if AT&T is too deep in bed with the state on this, what about IBM losing that huge amount of their foreign market share? At some point, business has to take up the Bill of Rights for their own selfish reasons here, you know?
Right, and I think that's what's happening. I mean, the tech companies, for the reasons I've laid out, the internet companies, have have always been a little bit skeptical of this. We know Yahoo challenged the first order they got back in 2007. Then IBM, people who do consulting work, are going to increasingly lose business overseas. China has different reasons to be skeptical of IBM than, say, Europe does of Google. But I think, you know, all those countries have reasons to be skeptical of American companies now. And AT&T is the most surveillance-friendly of any of the companies we know, and probably is the most surveillance-friendly of anyone not using it as a central business model. And even they were challenged by shareholders the other day about not disclosing the risks associated with being this deeply embedded with the national security state. And so I think, you know, that is one piece of leverage that is more likely to work for better and for worse than actual citizen engagement, because the president just doesn't care about us.
Yeah. Well, why would he? I mean.
Right, exactly.
Now, so we start talking about gerrymandering or whatever. We already know the game is rigged. It is what it is. We're stuck with the representatives we've got, and they can call themselves that all they want. All right, now, so let me ask you this about your very interesting piece in The Guardian about the NSA Review Board. They were going to follow your advice that you had already written about in The Guardian about how the offensive cyber warfare division should be split off from the rest of the NSA, and how then they changed their mind at the last minute. What's going on there?
Yeah, basically, NSA has three jobs. One job is to spy on what people are saying via satellite or email or what have you, and that's what we generally think of as NSA's job. Another one is to keep, originally this was just DOD's network, to keep DOD's network safe, so to keep the Chinese out of spying on DOD. That's number two, and that job has expanded of late because their cybersecurity job has expanded. And then the third job, which is new, is called Cyber Command. It's to attack people like Iran, to launch offensive cyber attacks on other countries. And that job, Cybercom, is supposed to be separate from NSA, but because General Alexander already has way too much power, they gave that to him as well. And the effect of that is that the things NSA does to make their spying and attack other people jobs easier make us in the United States less safe. They're basically leaving holes in the internet for the Chinese to come in and attack us on. And I had argued, other people had argued, that you got to split that up because it's just, A, too powerful of a position, and B, that means our country has really put offensive attacks on a much higher footing than just keeping the country safe. And so they did. They followed my advice, the review committee. And there were leaks coming out that they had embraced that position, which is you should split those positions. And then the NSC spokesperson came out and said, well, it's a draft. It's not done yet. And, oh, by the way, the president has already decided he will keep those positions in the same position. And there were a couple of interesting things about it. One is that I think the review committee, which is a classic D.C. whitewash, it's designed to, you know, defer attention so that
I forgot
we don't
there
have
even
actually
was one.
What's that?
I forgot there even was one.
Well, not me, because I have obsessed about it. But, you know, it was basically meant to be a whitewash. And for a variety of reasons, about halfway through, they said, oh, geez, we got to actually look like a committee. And so they proposed things. And yet Obama said, oh, you're supposed to be a whitewash, shut up. And he's already said he's going to ignore a lot of their recommendations. So in a sense, the whitewash committee kind of got out of control of the president, and the president's now in a position of having to stamp them down. But it's also that the president, you know, in spite of some really good reasons to split up this incredibly powerful position, is basically siding with this offensive strategy rather than a defensive one. And that probably doesn't make us more safe.
Yeah, I think I saw a blog entry where you wrote about how, of course, all they're talking about is Merkel's cell phone and whatever tabloid stuff, and completely ignoring all the major violations of the law and major violations of people's rights that are really at issue here.
Yeah, I mean, that originally that committee was designed to do two things. One is to say, golly, you shouldn't tap overseas leaders. You shouldn't tap presidents and prime ministers without asking the president first. And the second one is you should have much more stringent insider controls inside the NSA. Those were the recommendations that committee was
set
up
to stop future Snowdens, in other words.
Right. Stop. No more Snowden. And they were also supposed to be the ones that recommend cutting the sysadmin administrator positions in NSA dramatically and having computers do it all. That's what it was supposed to do. And then kind of the committee got overtaken by events, and partly by pressure from the software companies. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that when civil libertarians went in and said, this is a real problem, this is a real problem, this is a real problem, the review group just blew them off. But as soon as Microsoft went in and said, it's affecting my bottom line, and I suspect this was Cass Sunstein, because he's never met a corporate complaint that he didn't like. When the corporations came in and started complaining, then all of a sudden the review group started paying attention. But there's never, ever been significant attention paid to whether these programs work, whether they are too dangerous, whether they basically set up the infrastructure of totalitarianism, whether they could be done better with better technology. None of those questions have ever been asked, and we have no reason to believe they ever did get asked by that committee or will be asked.
Yeah, or the real long-term damage to the economy and all the unseen costs of what could have been, from here on.
Right.
Yep. And now, can you give us a word real quick about the terrible threat that China was going to turn off every Windows computer in the world or whatever it was the other night on 60 Minutes?
Oh, my God. So 60 Minutes basically got invited. That's my dog, by the way. He doesn't like surveillance either. 60 Minutes got invited in by the NSA to do a puff piece. And one of the spokespeople from the NSA was trying to talk about how dangerous cyber attacks are and basically said that China was going to do this BIOS attack. And a bunch of tech people have weighed in since then and said, well, that doesn't sound all that scary. And her take was that they were going to shut down a bunch of computers and with it shut down the American economy. And it was absolutely the most absurd claim. And, it was like all those claims that they made back in 2002 and 2003 about add-on Al-Qaeda attacks. It was like that, but because they were dealing with China, it was like orders of magnitude worse, because they were basically saying China, who is utterly reliant on our economy, was right. going to blow up our economy.
Right. Yeah, it was almost like the Y2K thing. All computers are going to just stop. None of them will ever start up again. They'll never get past that first black page that comes up.
And they'll blow up the world economy, and with it, you'll have 1.3 billion starving Chinese people, and the NSA actually wanted you to believe that China thought that was in their own best interest.
It's a good thing that the military is here to keep us all safe. That's all I gotta say.
It's just utterly absurd.
Yeah.
So it's good to... Go ahead.
I mean, the good news out of that was that all of Twitter agreed with you about that entire thing, and I think things really have changed in the public debate where, they were just trying to scare middle America, but middle America also rolled their eyes, too, and just said, come on, man, you can't threaten me with this stuff anymore.
There were people, it did get re-reported. They're like, oh, my gosh, horrible Chinese attack, and I was like, ooh, literally, they were accusing China of being a potential suicide cyber bomber, and that was going to take out the entire globe.
Yeah.
And I do think some of the immediate pushback helped.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thank goodness we've got you here. Thank you again for being on the show, Marcy.
Take care.
All right, everybody. That's the great Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, the caller on the blogosphere there, emptywheel.net, for her great blog, and follow her on Twitter too, @EmptyWheel. That's it for the show. See you tomorrow.